I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, celebrating our 100th birthday this year. Can't say too much about that. It's a big deal. We read this week that Costa Rica has not burned any fossil fuels for electricity in 2 months and thought, isn't that interesting? And how did they accomplish that? So this hour, Maria Gallucci, renewable energy reporter for Mashable, will explain. She's also worked as the energy and environment reporter at International Business Times, clean economy reporter for Inside Climate News, and she's been a correspondent in Mexico City. And their accomplishment in 2015 was even greater. Now, there are certain things that are going on in Costa Rica that aren't happening in the United States, but we might be able to learn some lessons, and we'll move a little bit beyond Costa Rica. Google has said it will power 100% of its global operations with renewables this coming year. It's this year now, right? It's 2017. Apple is going to partner with manufacturers to reduce carbon emissions from factories. Solar power is now cheaper than coal in some parts of the world. And we'll also talk about the Trump cabinet being well represented by people who are climate deniers. So we'll talk about how that factors into all of this hour with Maria. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Maria, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. I'm sure it's going to be an interesting hour. So what happened in Costa Rica is that hydropower alone, you write, accounted for about 80% of their total electricity generation in August. Tell me more about hydropower, and I would imagine that's something that might be peculiar to Costa Rica and other countries that have a whole lot of water around them.
Absolutely, yeah. So Costa Rica ended 2016 with 98.1% of its electricity coming from renewables, and as you said, most of those renewables were hydropower. The country gets a lot of seasonal rainfall and has multiple rivers that feed its dams, so they kind of have a natural advantage there. Another big advantage Costa Rica has is that it's relatively small. So I think I measured it's about the size of two Vermonts. So if you think about providing electricity for Costa Rica versus the United States, you know, they don't have to provide as much power. But, you know, that doesn't undermine sort of the achievements that they're making in the country.
And there's a six-year project that's just coming online this month, I believe, a hydroelectric project. What is that?
Sure. So it's just another hydropower facility that they're building to continue increasing electricity capacity in the country. They're also adding, I believe it's four new wind farms as well. So all of these projects that they have are mostly some form of green energy.
Mm-hmm. There are some problems associated with their hydrogen model, and tell me how significant this is, displacement of certain species, problems with communities having to relocate?
Sure. I'm not familiar with how extensive the problem is in Costa Rica, but that's certainly an issue that happens with any hydroelectric facility, and it's one reason why a lot of advocates of renewable energy have been pushing for other types of projects like wind and solar versus hydropower, because with these massive projects, especially like ones that you see in Brazil or China, it requires a whole-scale displacement of communities. It can completely disrupt the ecosystem. So there's a massive trade-off that you're making. In Costa Rica's case, these things may be happening, but probably on a much smaller scale than they would be in a place like China.
You cite figures of their use of solar power, which is just, and this surprised me, 0.01%. It's a sunny country. Why don't they have more solar power?
I'm not sure, but I know that that percentage is growing as it is in other parts of the world. And it may be simply that they have not had to ramp up solar power because of these other other resources that they have with hydropower, with wind, with geothermal. Solar power is increasingly becoming cheaper. It might be the cheapest form of electricity within this decade, but it has been kind of more expensive relative to other forms.
Mm-hmm. And is this hydroelectric power, is this something that's new to Costa Rica? Do you know, did they discover that this was important to get off fossil fuels because there was a movement to do that, to cut a carbon footprint? Or what was the impetus for it?
The country has a long-standing tradition of hydropower that has, I think, given sort of its resources, its rainfall and its rivers, has been sort of the most obvious choice. But the filling in sort of the gaps with wind, with geothermal, slowly but surely with solar, that's part of the country's sort of a bigger strategy to get its electricity from sources other than fossil fuels. And the country has sort of marketed itself as this ecotourism haven, and I think this bodes very well for its image as sort of a green country, sort of a green gem in Central America.
Mm-hmm. Have there been other countries in Central or South America that are following suit?
Certainly. In Mexico in particular, although it's much bigger than the Central American countries, has seen a lot of growth in wind and solar in particular, and in other Central American countries too, these projects are also taking off. They haven't taken off as quickly as they would in a bigger economy like Mexico or the United States, but there is progress being seen across the board. Part of this is kind of geared toward the country's renewable energy goals or their efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but increasingly the reason they're adopting renewables is because they are affordable. In many countries, particularly island countries, they have to import their coal or their oil to burn, and they're finding it's increasingly cheaper to just build the solar plant, build the wind farm on land and use local electricity in that way.
And tell me more about geothermal. Does that account for a great deal of energy production in Costa Rica?
It's the second largest source, and it's roughly, last year accounted for about 13%. So it's not huge, but it's a sizable portion.
And when you look at, we started the hour by talking about they're going 76 straight days on carbon-free electricity from June 16 to September 2nd. In 2015, I think they went something like 299 days on carbon-free electricity.
Well, and actually the figure that you're citing was from September, but for the year end, they went 250 days. In 2016, they went 250 days without using any fossil fuels. Those weren't consecutive days, but that was throughout the year. So slightly lower than 2015, but certainly on par.
Isn't that something? I wonder how many other countries on Earth, Maria, compare to that, if there's anybody who's done as well.
I don't think so. And again, it's sort of this big home advantage that Costa Rica has with its hydropower. But I think for a lot of proponents of renewable energy, this makes them very excited to say, here's a country that actually, barely uses any fossil fuels. What a great motivation. Wouldn't it be great if the rest of the world could get to that as well?
Right. You say in your piece, it's easy to see a model for fossil fuel dependent nations to follow. But I want you to concentrate on the example big polluters of the world can easily emulate anytime soon. It may not be as easy to do that. And I'm wanting you to concentrate on the size, the physical size of Costa Rica, about twice the size of Vermont. So it doesn't need to generate all that much power. Does it, though, mean that Vermont could take this on, states could take all of this on a much smaller scale, so it could be comparable in some ways to what's going on in Costa Rica?
I think so, absolutely. And you're seeing in the U.S., some states have started taking this on. Certainly none have sort of achieved this balance of mostly renewable energy versus not much fossil fuels. But I think at a state-by-state level, we could see this. Some of the challenges that exist are that a state government is different than a national government, in that it might not have sort of the resources that it needs, or there might be multi-state utility connections that complicate efforts for states to do kind of achieve their goals independently. But when we take it in smaller chunks like this, yes, I think that we could see a lot of progress.
You also remind us of things that are going on elsewhere. Google talking about powering 100% of its global operations with renewables. Apple saying a couple months ago they would partner with their manufacturers to reduce carbon emissions from factories. Are they using Costa Rica as a model? And can you tell us more about what Google and Apple are doing?
Sure. I don't know that they're using Costa Rica as a model per se, because it's sort of different. Their operations are spread all over the world, so it's not just dealing with the electricity grid in one confined boundary. It's dealing with it in different jurisdictions with different resources available. The major energy major technology companies like Google and Apple are huge consumers of energy. First of all, for their data centers, for their offices, and so they're coming under increasing pressure to get that electricity from a clean source and not add more carbon emissions to the grid when they store all of our information, all the things that we send into the cloud. So Google this year expects to get all of the energy that it consumes in its direct operations from renewables. Apple has achieved that and is now working to also get its manufacturing suppliers, its sort of third-party suppliers, to follow suit. And that's a huge step, because oftentimes with companies, they can say, yes, we're reducing our own emissions, but meanwhile, the companies that make the products, that make the iPhone and ship it, they aren't necessarily reducing their emissions. So there's an effort now for companies to compensate for all of the emissions that the products create in the supply chain.
And what are they using in terms of renewable? Is it solar? Is it wind? What is it?
It's mostly wind and solar power. Google has emphasized wind power especially, and has invested billions of dollars or backed billion-dollar projects for wind in the United States and beyond, and solar as well. Those are sort of the two main favorites.
You talk about solar power now being cheaper than coal in some parts of the world. That's according to Bloomberg, that in less than a decade, it's likely to be the lowest cost option almost everywhere. Why is it low cost now? And I guess I don't understand why it's taken so long for solar to become low cost.
Sure. So a lot of the big reason why the costs are declining and continuing to decline has to do with the technology and also the economies of scale. So before there was much interest in solar, when it was sort of more of a niche product, the technology was much less efficient, much more expensive to manufacture. Financing costs were higher because banks didn't really trust or understand these projects. But what's happened is that as more and more solar panels are produced, more projects are installed, the world is sort of becoming more comfortable with the idea of these. And I've heard it described sort of as the Walmart effect. There's a higher volume and lower margin on these projects, and that's driven the cost of solar down about 62% since 2009, and with cuts made across the supply chain. And that's just continuing, and that's why, as you mentioned, Bloomberg New Energy Finance expects solar to be cheaper than using coal on the global average by 2025.
And where does the U.S. fit in all of this? Are we at the forefront of using solar more, or are other countries doing more in this regard?
We are at the forefront. European countries were actually the first to come out and use solar power. Germany in particular, they had a lot of government programs that incentivized installation of solar, and those have kind of fallen by the wayside as the governments have less support now with all the economic situation happening there. But China has become this huge powerhouse of investment in solar and is investing hundreds of billions of dollars to build new projects. And the U.S. is also a major player and has seen a dramatic growth in both these large-scale, sort of sprawling utility solar projects and also rooftop solar projects.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that China really has to do something, because it's really hard to breathe in a lot of the big cities in China, right? The pictures are terrible.
Exactly. And actually, China today announced that it would be investing $361 billion by 2020 in renewable energy. And a big part of that investment is trying to reduce its dependence on coal plants. As you mentioned, the country, the northern part of China, has been dealing with a week-long sort of smog event that is very dangerous to breathe. It's hazardous. Flights are being canceled. You can't even drive on the roads. And for a long time, coal power was sort of underpinned the China's manufacturing growth, but now they are trying to move away from that. Certainly, they won't be getting rid of coal, but they want to get away from sort of the debilitating pollution and smog and greenhouse gas emissions as well.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We'll also move into a discussion of Donald Trump's nominees to be heads of various agencies. The head of the EPA is going to be a climate change denier. What does all of that do to where we go with a renewable energy? I'm sure that people like Tillerson will be questioned about this issue next Wednesday. I think the hearing is on his nomination and on others. They're doing a lot of hearings all on the same day. So the questions to you, maybe some of you have been in Costa Rica and have firsthand experience of how they are using renewable. It's an amazing story coming from there and their reliance on alternate forms of energy. There is a movement in China and in Europe, of course. Our guest was saying Germany is at the forefront. We're doing a lot with solar power, which has become inexpensive. Costa Rica, though, is getting a lot of attention because of the numbers that were just released recently at the end of the year about how their energy demands were met by renewable in a large way in the last couple months and really in the last couple of years. Our phone number, we'd like to have you join our conversation. I know this is a topic of interest to many of you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Maria Gallucci is our guest. She's renewable energy reporter for Mashable, has worked as the energy and environment reporter at International Business Times, clean economy reporter for Inside Climate News, and as a correspondent in Mexico City. This is the Ideas Network. Let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Daniel in Milwaukee, our first caller for you. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Good.
So, this is not a tangent, but I've been taking environmental science classes because I'm going to college and I've been interested in learning about this topic that I didn't really know anything about short of what's on the news. And one thing I thought was interesting was my environmental science teacher compared the term climate change denier to sort of the Dark Ages Catholic Church controlling research, where research was allowed as long as it supported the predetermined state's narrative. And so I guess I was looking for the guest's opinion on kind of the dangers of using those terms to limit the scientific method, which includes trying to disprove our theories. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. That's a great question. It's very. I think especially as reporters or even scientists trying to figure out how to put a name on this idea of, you know, the rejection of mainstream climate science versus sort of the natural scientific process, which does have a lot of sort of doubt and rebuttals, et cetera, can be difficult. But when I use the term climate change skeptic, it's particularly referring to sort of the rejection of the overwhelming global scientific consensus that human activity is causing climate change. And the reason for that is because there are efforts, I believe, to deliberately confuse people about what we do understand and what we don't understand. And by kind of using the word skeptic, it's kind of a signal in some ways that they aren't speaking sort of apart from the mainstream consensus. And I certainly don't support putting dissent in a basement or shutting it off. But I think it's important to kind of separate that from deliberate attempts to confuse people or to suggest that we don't really know what's happening when, as I mentioned, the large majority of the world's climate scientists say, yes, human activity, burning fossil fuels, deforestation, is contributing to climate change. There is discussion and debate about to what extent, when the impacts will occur, how they'll look and where, but the sort of human's role in that is not really up for debate.
So what does it mean, and you've written about this, to have Scott Pruitt as the head of the EPA, Republican Attorney General in Oklahoma, a long record of suing the EPA, the very organization he's been nominated to lead. He opposed, you write, the agency's Clean Power Plan, seeking to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, and has said, and I quote, scientists continue to disagree about the degree and extent of global warming and its connections to the actions of mankind. The debate should be encouraged in classrooms, public forums, and the halls of Congress.
It is really sort of, I guess, interesting and confusing to think about what it might mean to have somebody who is kind of self-described advocate against the EPA. What would it mean to have him sort of at the helm of a lot of these rules and regulations? He, as you mentioned, he's fighting to dismantle the Clean Power Plan, which is the Obama administration's effort to regulate emissions from power plants. He's also opposed rules around clean air and water. And so it's sort of unclear as to what it means. How do you guide an agency? How do you head an agency when you disagree with sort of its foundation? And as you mentioned, sort of he, among other nominees by President-elect Trump, disagree with the mainstream view among climate scientists that they don't think the science is settled. It is, but they're trying to sort of encourage these discussions and cast this as something that maybe we should be talking more about rather than working to address.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how it's going to affect the people who are doing research on renewable energy in universities all over the country?
I think a lot of researchers, certainly ones that I've spoken to, are genuinely concerned that their research budgets might be slashed, that they might have less leeway to do the work that they're doing because there's not really much of an interest, doesn't seem to be much of an interest in the incoming Trump administration. And so what that means for our ability to fight climate change and develop renewable energy and protect the air and water, it's kind of too hard to speculate, but I know researchers themselves are wondering, what am I going to be doing if I don't have the resources to do this work?
Thanks very much, Daniel, for your call. Let's go next to Gary in Merrill. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi. To the global warming thing, I think there's plenty of evidence to say that by 2032 we're going to be going into a mini ice age. But as far as Costa Rica and the United States, if you took a couple electric furnaces that make steel and maybe a couple assembly plants, you might take up all the electric that that country can produce. We can't run on solar, not if we're going to have factories and huge plants that take probably one of our states would use more electric than the whole country could. We have coal out of Wyoming that goes to many different states. We have natural gas. We burn it cleaner than any other country in the world, and we should be prouder of ourselves. That's my opinion.
All right. Thank you. Maria?
Sure. I absolutely agree with you. Comparing Costa Rica to the United States is apples and oranges. The United States has much more manufacturing, a much bigger economy, huge electricity demand. And so you're right. We can't overnight just replace all of our electricity demand with renewables. That said, many analysts in the U.S. and globally believe it's possible that we could run our factories, our steel mills, what have you, with renewable energy. It will take time. It will take a lot of money, but it's possible, is what experts are saying. But I agree with you. We in the U.S. shouldn't feel ashamed of our electricity footprint or sort of our electricity mix. It's very different than Costa Rica here. But I do think, though, that it's not impossible that the U.S. could find itself in a place like Costa Rica in the future.
Do you think that coal is going to be expanded? Are coal jobs coming back to this country? Should they?
Well, I don't think so, and that's not because it's not even a question of should they, but it rather is a question of economics. As our caller mentioned, the U.S. has seen an explosion in natural gas production, and that's really knocked coal out of the competition. The U.S. last year, I believe, produced more electricity with natural gas than coal, which has not happened. And because of that, it's hard to imagine a scenario in which the coal mines are suddenly active and thriving, and even coal demand globally is expected to pick up in China and India, but not necessarily to the extent that coal companies were hoping. So we will continue to have coal, certainly, but I don't think in the current economic situation that it will go back to what it used to be in the United States.
Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Bill. Hi, Bill. Oops, I got to press the right button for that to happen. Hi, Bill. Hello, Bill. Well, Bill isn't there, so let us go to Kathleen in Lake Geneva. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Well, I have an overriding belief that there are two main groups that deny climate change. That is the uninformed, and two, those with economic investments in fossil fuels. For example, Trump and his new EPA director. The military is basing their future sustainability on alternative energy. So if these guys are so pro-military, why aren't they echoing what the military is doing rather than the opposite? That's my question.
That's a great... I'm sorry. I was going to say that's a great point. And in fact, the supporters of Trump have even sort of mocked this position of the U.S. military to say that climate change is a threat. You know, the reaction has been, well, ISIS is a threat. Focus on that. Forget about climate change. But that's an important point, that the U.S. military, the intelligence community, sees the fact that climate change is going to further destabilize populations, is going to create even more refugees than we have now, is going to make certain parts of the world uninhabitable, and that alone is a huge security threat, let alone what happens when you have to start fighting over increasingly scarce resources.
Thanks very much for your call, Kathleen. I'm going to spend just a few more minutes on geothermal. I've visited places that are getting their energy from geothermal in Wisconsin. Why isn't this more widespread? Is this a complicated technology? Can most places use geothermal?
Sure. I'm not sure that it's necessarily complicated, but I believe that geothermal, that a place has to have those resources. So whereas you can build solar panels and put them in places like Germany that doesn't even have that much sun, or you can put wind farms wherever, geothermal is more tied to its location. And I'm not sure maybe why it hasn't gotten as much glamour and appeal as wind and solar. Certainly it sort of can seem like an afterthought when we talk about renewable energy, but it is, as you mentioned, in parts of the U.S. and worldwide, an important player in the electricity mix.
Bob asks, I don't know if you can answer this, but we'll give you the question. What are we going to do with all the batteries, old batteries from the solar and wind, when they are unable to hold a charge from the solar panels in the wind turbines?
That is a good question. I know that I don't know too much about this area, but I do know that there are discussions and strategies for recycling these batteries, finding ways to give them new life, to dispose of them, to kind of take those resources from them and apply them to other applications. So it is an area that is being talked about. It's certainly an important one as well, because you're right, if we just toss all these batteries, well, that's a huge environmental threat in itself. But it is an area that the renewable energy community is working on, as far as I understand.
Let's talk about some of the other nominees. Rick Perry as the energy secretary, the former governor, you have written, said he doesn't think carbon emissions, the main driver of climate change, are harmful pollutants. He's also called for the elimination of the Department of Energy. What's he going to do on his job?
I don't know. He's interesting because as governor of Texas, he oversaw both a huge boom in the state's
oil and gas industry, but also a huge boom in wind power. So he's not necessarily opposed to renewable energy or this idea that we'd have alternatives. But as you mentioned, in 2011, when he was contending to be the Republican nominee in the 2012 election, he vowed to dismantle the Department of Energy. He sees it as very wasteful. We should just do away with it. So I'm not sure how his mind has changed now that he's been tapped to lead that same agency. But there is concern among clean energy scientists and researchers that that former Governor Perry could sort of encourage huge budget cuts. And the Department of Energy is a major supporter of cutting-edge clean energy research. It sort of helped spark all of these large-scale solar power plants in the U.S. So there is concern that those funds would be kind of disappear overnight and folks would sort of be left trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to advance alternative energy?
Yeah. It must be weird for him to be on the job for the first day and having the history, as you just outlined, of saying the department should not be in existence. Well, here I am. I'm Secretary of the Department of Energy, and I don't really think we should be around. You would think, put him in a slightly weird position.
Right, and it's a very similar case with Scott Pruitt, who is the nominee for the EPA. He's also... as I mentioned, he said he's a leading advocate against EPA's activist agenda. Those are his own words. So it's interesting to think of what he's going to do when he is at the helm. Same with right. With Perry.
Kathleen, thanks for your call. Rod is next. Hi, Rod.
Yes, hello. Thanks. Thank you, Kathleen. Another interesting program. Say, I was just kind of wondering, you know, I scrap metal scrap and stuff, and I dumpster dive too. I'm proud of it. And when I see the stuff that gets thrown out yet, you know, there's a waste energy plant in Barron County. Now, I don't know what percent of the electricity they're providing, like just in Barron County, but I called the man there, the operator there, and how much energy can be produced from stuff that already has been expelled energy that is getting buried yet, that can be turned into energy by burning the waste energy plants. And also, I was kind of wondering on these solar panels, you know, I see where a lot of people now are actually making the roof the solar panel, so you don't have these things protruding up. You know, some people don't like the looks of them. It doesn't bother me. But if it's the roof itself, it's killing two birds with one stone. And also the nuclear energy, you got to wonder about this waste from the nuclear plants, how much of it is actually waste, because they claim that the Japanese are utilizing these spent fuel rods to a way more efficient amount than we are. And that's all.
All right, that's a lot. That's a lot. Thanks, Rod. Go ahead, Maria, wherever you want to start.
Sure. Well, I'll start with waste to energy. There are certain states that have a number of these plants, and certainly there are countries. I know Sweden actually is one that burns its garbage for electricity. These play generally a smaller role, though, in the electricity mix. And part of that, I think, is historically plants have been associated with pollution. They would burn waste or burn garbage for electricity without sort of doing much to cap or reduce the toxic air coming out of their smokestack. So it's sort of like you're not really fixing the problem in that way. That said, today's plants are different. I know there are companies that are hoping to kind of revive waste to energy, especially as we have kind of increasing amounts of garbage. So it'll be exciting to see where that goes. And you also mentioned solar tiles or solar roof panels. Those are really interesting. Tesla and Solar City, last month or a few months ago, introduced this new line of tiles that generate solar electricity, but they look like the slates that you would put on your roof. And that is really exciting because, as you said, a lot of people, or some people maybe don't like the protruding sort of system on your rooftop. The idea is if you could put these panels, these tiles on, they look more discreet, they're not as noticeable, then maybe you could get sort of more of a cultural acceptance of solar as well. So there's really a lot of exciting things happening in clean energy.
Thanks, Rod, so much for your call. Pete in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and to the guests. Hey, a few minutes ago, Kathleen, you were talking past the guests because you used the term geothermal, which the guest needs to know. In Wisconsin, that's the marketing term that's applied to ground source heat pumps. In terms of an underground heat reservoir to generate steam, we have nothing of that sort in Wisconsin. But here, ground source heat pumps are marketed as geothermal, so I wanted to clarify that confusion.
Okay.
And also, a caller asked about batteries and recycling them for wind turbines and solar panels. Well, neither of them by themselves have batteries. They could be part of a system, but especially utility-scale wind turbines, they don't have batteries. And if they did, of course, we'd recycle them the same way we recycle the batteries in our cars. So, you know, there's no news there. Okay? That's all I had to say.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Maria, you want to respond?
Sure, and thank you for clarifying. That is a good point. I think in my mind I was thinking about batteries for energy storage. So now when we talk about renewables, there's this push to build solar panels and wind turbines in combination with batteries that could store the power and then use it when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. Those batteries are, the cost of those are coming down rapidly, and those are expected to sort of proliferate households and businesses as well. So when those do become more commonplace, then that recycling question will happen. But thank you for clarifying that on the part about solar and wind.
Let's go back to Tesla for a moment. Somewhere lodged in the recesses of my mind, somebody told me about Tesla and some other amazing projects they're doing. I'm also interested in, you think of Tesla, you think of cars, where we're going to be in terms of transportation 20 years from now, the drive to have more electric cars, if it's strong, if it's weakening, and what Tesla is up to.
Sure, Tesla is up to a lot. They, Elon Musk, the company's CEO, is kind of advocated for Tesla as this all-around energy company. So they would create the solar panels and the solar systems that produce energy, store it in a battery made by Tesla, and that battery charges your Tesla car. So they kind of envision this whole life cycle of products. And Tesla recently acquired Solar City, which is a major rooftop solar installer to sort of complete this vision. So they have a lot going on. They actually this week opened up their enormous, they call it a gigafactory for producing batteries in Nevada, and that's where they'll be making a lot of these batteries for their home storage systems for the Tesla cars. So they have a lot happening, and as I said, it's sort of geared toward positioning Tesla as this all-around energy company.
Do you think we're going to be driving more cars that don't use fossil fuels 5 years from now, 10 years?
That's the way it's looking. I think that proponents of electric cars were far more optimistic a few years ago that we would have more of these cars on the road, that they would be sort of more appealing to consumers. They haven't quite taken off in the way that people wanted, but that we are, sales are rising. More people are driving them. Costs are falling, which is important because if you think about it, the some of these models can run as high as $100,000 or you know, they might range in the $30,000 to $40,000. So it's not a really an economy car yet, but that's where manufacturers want to go.
And let's go. Thank you, Pete, for your call. Dan is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Dan. Dan, are you there? Dan is not there. Let's welcome more phone calls. Our lines are open to you right now. We're talking, well, we start our conversation with Costa Rica and the fact that Costa Rica has not burned any fossil fuels for electricity in a two-month period of time and didn't burn very many fossil fuels during all of last year, 2016. So we talked about how they accomplished that and if there are renewable forms they're using that might be models for other parts of the world, including the United States. We're looking at an administration where quite a few of the incoming heads of the EPA, Department of Energy, and other places, Secretary of State, have said either very negative comments about the climate change and whether or not we're responsible for any of that or have strong financial interest in the fossil fuel industry. So where does that leave us in terms of our future with renewable energy? And what's the rest of the world doing when it comes to renewable energy? That's what we are talking about this hour and welcoming your phone calls for Maria Gallucci. Our phone number is 800-486-8255. 8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Okay, let us go to Nate in Milwaukee next. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to mention that I think that the guest who met as a person who called in earlier probably sincerely believed it, but as far as I'm aware, there is no one predicting with any amount of scientific certitude the idea that we've got an ice age coming in 2030. But your guest mentioned how to deal with people who distort the record on global warming or the science. And I would say this, the term that applies is actually pretty old. It's called propaganda. And I look at the denialist propaganda online repeatedly. I find some of the websites relatively well-refined, but a common theme among many is, or at least some of the more recent ones I've seen, is they'll selectively edit articles where they won't show the majority of articles saying global warming is going on, it's a problem. They have a habit of actually patting themselves on the back and claiming their world-renowned institutions, which is kind of like giving themselves a trophy, but you won't find a great deal of science, which makes me believe it's a not a big group of people, but a certainly well-funded one. But yeah, it's an old practice. People have used propaganda for years, and I think the word propagandist actually applies.
So where do you think we are in terms of renewable energy and our direction on energy with the new administration, Nate?
I am somewhat concerned because I certainly don't think I see a great deal to be hopeful of in terms of some of Trump's appointments. Now, Tom Friedman made the claim that he doesn't think Trump believes some of the things Trump has said as probably the moment he says it, so no one knows what Trump is going to do, which leaves a window of optimism. But the appointments I find certainly discouraging, and I would say I wouldn't want to have to, but it's probably a wise idea that some of the scientists in government are making copies of data relating to global warming in Canada, so that if the, say, head of the EPA, once Trump is president, wants to delete everything, they won't be able to take all the copies. One of the things I think they should do is make sure they save websites that make information about global warming relatively easy to understand, so that someone can off the street look at a chart or something and understand what they're talking about.
I guess you are worried, Maria, and yet Donald Trump, at the behest of his daughter Ivanka Trump, did invite Al Gore and Leonardo DiCaprio to Trump Tower. What came of that?
I would say not much. I mean, soon after those meetings, Donald Trump, he's kind of, the way he talks about climate change has sort of changed, but I don't know that the root of what he believes has changed. But in the past, he talked about climate change as being a hoax, perhaps one invented by China. Now he sort of says, well, they don't really know. They, probably being scientists, they don't really know what's happening. There's a lot of debate. He says he has an open mind. And those sort of quotes have come since his meeting with Al Gore. But it sort of gives this false idea that, yeah, maybe Trump will be flexible. And as a caller mentioned, it's kind of hard to know what President-elect Trump really means, because when he says they don't really know, we don't really know what's happening with climate change, that's not true if you accept the mainstream consensus that humans are contributing to global warming. So it's really, like with anything, it's kind of hard to wrap your mind around.
Thanks, Nate, for your call. We go to Dean in Fond du Lac next. Hi, Dean.
Hi there. I'm just wondering where we would be if it hadn't been for President Ronald Reagan. He absolutely destroyed all of the programs that Carter had set up that would have moved us closer to renewable energy, even went so far as to take the solar panels off the White House roof. You know, where would we be 36 years later if we hadn't had the presidency of Ronald Reagan?
What do you think, Maria? You got thoughts on that?
I do. I think that, as you mentioned, President Reagan took solar panels off the White House's rooftop. So I think we would certainly be farther along than we are today because there would have been more investment. There would have been more interest. A lot of the projects or development of renewable energy waned under President Reagan and subsequent administrations and has since sort of ramped up, and now the whole world is doing it as well. But that said, I don't think that the U.S. is wealthy in coal, oil, and natural gas, and I don't think that we, over that time, even if President Reagan had embraced renewables, we would have ever sort of gotten the country to say, okay, let's leave all of that in the ground, let's not use any of it. And that's the point that we're at today, sort of what we know now about, or we knew then too, but what we know about climate change and the need to reduce emissions from burning fossil fuels. So I guess the point is, who knows? We would have had more renewables, but we probably would continue using fossil fuels.
Were there any presidents after Jimmy Carter who thought about reinstalling the solar panels? Do you know? Maria?
No, I'm not sure. I probably knew at some point, but my memory's failing me.
I wonder why nobody did that, because I'm sure some of them probably thought it was a good idea. Dean, thanks for the call. We go to Scott in Eagle Point. Hi.
Yeah, well, I think the answer to your question there was probably they couldn't afford the lease on the solar panels to put them back in the White House.
Mm.
Just kidding there. My question's more kind of focused on the local area within Wisconsin. You know, I did an estimate to have solar panels put on my house, but there was very limited options available for us, you know, in rural areas in Eagle Point to get solar panels. It's either it's really just a one-stop shop where you have to go through the purchase plan. And the estimate came in even with rebates at around $25,000.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, my return on investment would have been like 15 to 20 years. So when it comes to these areas that are kind of remote, out in the middle, no, I get a lot of sunlight in my area, so solar panels would be really great for me, but the cost associated with that just doesn't balance itself out. I know in other areas, I don't know specifically throughout the state of Wisconsin, but I used to live in Albany, New York, and they have a lot of lease options that they do with power companies where they lease the panels and utilize the excess energy to put back on the grid. And that doesn't seem to be an option for us around here. And I'm wondering if there's any strategy locally for us to make that more affordable and accessible so that it becomes more of a reasonable option for us to choose from.
Interesting. We have about a minute left, Maria.
Sure. Well, I would say, and I'm not familiar with sort of how utility regulations work in Wisconsin, but community solar is increasingly becoming an option for people who like yourself, who are interested in going solar, but find the sort of economics don't work out to get their own system. So I would, if you haven't already, I would suggest looking up options for community solar, which is sort of people pulling together their resources and investing in one common project to sort of spread the costs and spread the benefits around as well.
When he gave you that $25,000 to install in his house, did that seem exorbitantly high to you, Maria?
Not really. I think that it's, there's so much diversity in terms of the costs and options that people have in the U.S. and places like California. You could shop it out. You could find a place that fits what you need and the price, sort of your price point. But in more rural areas where there's maybe less interest or less investment, I think that price that sounds pretty reasonable, or not reasonable, but what you might expect.
About average. Maria, thanks very much for being with us in conducting a wide range interview. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maria Gallucci, renewable energy reporter for Mashable. She's worked as the energy and environment reporter at International Business Times and the clean economy reporter for Inside Climate News. We thank her for being with us to start the conversation talking about renewable energy in Costa Rica, where they're doing just fine, thank you, and moving on to a conversation about geothermal and wind and solar. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from NPR, and then stay with us. We're going to have some fun. Get your pens and papers ready so you can take down some great quotations from the author of Metaphors Be With You.